Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Thursday. It's March 10th. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We have a slightly different broadcast today. We're not going to begin today, which is Thursday, with the Driving Me Crazy duo, John and Lori Wiles. They're on vacation. So I'm going to begin the first half hour with you. And then on Thursdays, we're always joined by none other than Brian Harrod. He's the Yonkers Newswire publisher and editor. It sounds like I'm stammering a little bit because I had to answer the door had to run back and forth with a couple of things, so I'm a little bit confused. And I thought for a moment there I almost missed the opening moment of the broadcast. Literally within seconds, I got here back on time. So there's a lot to talk about today, and we're going to begin with something that was very unexpected, and that's with regard to South Korea. It seems that the opposition conservative candidate for presidential election, a guy by the name of Yoon Suk-yeol, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, evidently won. So South Korean opposition candidate Yoon Suk-yeol was elected president on Wednesday's election, with the ruling party candidate Lee Jae-myung conceding defeat and congratulating his opponent. With more than 95% of the votes counted and Yoon leading, Lee spoke to reporters at Democratic Party headquarters early on Thursday and conceded he had fallen short. The unusually bitter election campaign was marred by scandals and smears, but the policy stakes are high for the country of 52 million people. Around 77% of South Korea's 44 million eligible voters cast ballots to pick the leader of a nation whose global status is rising even as it has been riven by gender and generational divisions while facing a confrontational. The winner must tackle challenges, including South Korea's worst wave of COVID-19 infections, growing inequality and surging home prices, while navigating an increasingly tense rivalry between China and the United States. The voters also want the new president to root out graft and pursue negotiations to curb North Korea's nuclear ambitions. An exit poll jointly conducted by KBS, I guess that's Korean Broadcasting Service, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, and two other major broadcasters has shown that Yoon slight lead with 48.4% and another one by cable network JTBC put Lee ahead with 48.4% to Yoon's 47.7%. Talk about a squeaker. This was unbelievable. So, these are just the sort of things that can happen. So every vote does count. that's the bottom line. So that's something to think about. Bear with me a moment as we move on to some other things. Now, you may not have known this. The Polish offer to donate MiG-29 jets to Ukraine had taken the U.S. officials by surprise. So it seems an offer from Poland to donate MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine took U.S. officials by surprise on Tuesday, raising fears the move could draw NATO allies into more direct conflict with Russia. Vice President Kamala Harris arrives in Warsaw on Wednesday and for talks on how to help Ukraine counter Putin's aggression. The Pentagon on Tuesday rejected Poland's surprise announcement that it would give the United States its MiG-29 fighter jets for use by Ukraine, describing the offer as untenable. Well, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said that Poland's declaration that it intended to deliver the 28 jets to the U.S. Ramstein Air Base in Germany raised the concerning prospect of warplanes departing from a U.S. and NATO base to fly into airspace contested with Russia in the Ukraine conflict. Quote, we will continue to consult with Poland and our other NATO allies about this issue and the difficult logistical challenges it presents, but we do not believe Poland's proposal is a tenable one, Kirby said in a statement. Well, the Pentagon went further late on Wednesday, saying it would oppose any plan for NATO nations to provide fighter jets to Ukraine, calling it high risk. The proposed gift of more warplanes would be a morale booster for Ukrainians under pounding Russian assault for nearly 2 weeks. But it also raises the risk of the war expanding beyond Ukraine. Russia has declared that supporting Ukraine's air force would be tantamount to joining the war and could spur retaliation. White House officials were blindsided by the Polish announcement on the MiGs. The proposal did not come up during talks with Secretary of State Antony Blinken when he was recently in Poland, according to a U.S. official familiar with the talks. Well, the official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said that White House officials did not think the proposal would easily solve the logistical challenges of providing aircraft to Ukraine. Now, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland told lawmakers at a hearing on the Ukraine crisis on Tuesday she learned of Poland's plans only while driving to the hearing. To my knowledge, it wasn't pre-consulted with us, end quote, Nuland told senators. German officials also said there were no plans for MiGs to be flying out of Ramstein Air Base. Well, Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany noted that Germany has given Ukraine financial and humanitarian aid, as well as some weapons, he added. But it is also true that we have to consider very carefully what we do concretely, and definitely warplanes are not part of that, end quote. So a spokesperson for the foreign ministry added that any decisions needed to be made with the goal of preventing the war in Ukraine from spilling over into NATO. And Ukraine is pleading, though, on the other hand, for warplanes. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called upon, again on Wednesday, upon Western powers to urgently make a decision on the fighter jets. Quote, when will there be a decision? Look, we're at war, Zelensky said in a video on his Telegram channel. We ask you again to decide as soon as possible. Send us planes, end quote. But the handover of Poland's 28 Soviet-made MiG-29s would be unlikely to be a game-changer militarily. MiG-29s are inferior to more sophisticated Russian aircraft and could be easy prey for Russian pilots and missiles. Ukraine has been pleading for more warplanes as it resists mightier Russian forces. Washington has been looking at a proposal under which Poland would supply Ukraine with MiG-29s and would receive in exchange American F-16s. Ukrainian pilots are trained to fly the Soviet-era MiG-29s. Any MiG transfer would be fraught with complications. Neither NATO nor the European Union wants to be seen as directly involved in such a transaction, which would sharply raise already extreme tensions with Russia. Tense, that NATO and the European Union are not direct participants in the Ukraine conflict, U.S. and Polish officials have been considering a variety of options. Under one scenario, Poland would deliver fighter jets to the U.S. base in Germany, where they would be repainted and flown to a non-NATO, non-European Union country. Ukrainian pilots would then come to fly them to Ukraine. No country has been publicly identified as a transit point, but Kosovo, a non-aligned country that is very friendly with the United States, has been mentioned as one of several nations that might be willing to serve as a middle point. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said on Wednesday that any decision about delivering offensive weapons must be made unanimously by NATO members. Quote, this is why we are able to give all of our fleet of jet fighters to Ramstein. but we are not ready to make any moves on our own because we are not a party to this war, he said. Now, Poland publicly floated the plan to donate its MiGs the day before Vice President Kamala Harris was scheduled to depart for Warsaw for talks with Polish officials. The offer and subsequent U.S. refusal is likely to add an awkward layer to the talks, which were expected to focus largely on U.S. efforts to help Poland and other Eastern European nations struggling to take in some 2 million refugees since the war started. A senior U.S. defense official has said that Ukrainians are flying relatively few of their existing aircraft for relatively little time as it is. The defense official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the U.S. assessment, said it's possible that Ukraine does not need more planes and would benefit most from more of the weapons it uses effectively every day, including anti-aircraft Stinger and anti-tank Javelin missiles. The official also said that Russia currently has the capacity to reach almost the entire country of Ukraine with its surface-to-air missiles, including from within Russia and from ships in the Black Sea. So that's the story there, and a very frightening circumstance, that's to say the least. Well, let's just look at something else, which is very interesting as well. Putin is very friendly with a French actor by the name of Depardieu, who objects to the fratricidal war. Well, French actor Gérard Depardieu, a friend of Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday, came out against the war in Ukraine and called for negotiations. Russia and Ukraine have always been brother countries, the 73-year-old film star told Agence France-Presse in a phone call. Quote, I am against this fratricidal war. I say stop the weapons and negotiate, Depardieu had said. In 2013, he sparked a huge outcry by leaving France and taking Russian nationality in protest at a proposed tax hike on the rich in his homeland of France. Putin treated him to a dinner to present him with his new citizenship, and Depardieu was subsequently full of praise for the strongman. I will say what I think about Putin. The Russian nation needs a person just like this with a Russian temper. Putin is trying to return just a bit of dignity back to the people, he said after the dinner. Only last month, as tensions soared at the Ukraine border, Depardieu opened an Instagram account with a picture of himself embracing Putin. He also said on French television, leave Vladimir alone, end quote. Depardieu became a star in France from the 1980s with roles in The Last Metro, Police, Cyrano de Bergerac, before Peter Weil's Green Card also made him a Hollywood celebrity. He later acted in global productions, including Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, Ang Lee's Life of Pi, and Netflix's Marseille series. Now, in 2015, Ukraine blacklisted Depardieu in apparent retribution for his reported refusal to recognize the independence of the former Soviet state. The Culture Ministry gave no official reason for the ban at the time, but it had previously identified Depardieu and other Russia-friendly international film stars as national security threats whose movies should be banned. In 2021, the actor was charged with raping and sexually assaulting a young French actress at his home in Paris 3 years earlier. He denied the accusation. Well, now, this is very interesting with regard to Ukraine. In a nod to Russia, Ukraine says it no longer is insisting on NATO membership. And that was just about a week ago, but it's something to, that was about 2 days ago, but it's something to consider because there have been different plans on this. Hold on a moment, because that hasn't come through for some reason. Okay, I lost my notes, I think, on that. Bear with me a moment. We'll see in a moment. Tell you, I don't know about you, but I do feel, for some crazy reason, that there's an overwhelming amount of traffic on the internet, or that there are just so many more people who've come online that it is literally stalling a process. It's not working as well as it used to even 3 months back. Okay, so it just is what it is. Okay, so let's just look and see what else we got, because that didn't come up for some crazy reason. And let me just see if we can get this. 1 second. And this is very unusual, because I didn't think that in 2 weeks' time that half of Kiev's population has fled the Russian invasion. That's what the mayor there says. So literally unbelievable that that's taking so many people have left the country, have left the city. Truly amazing. Now, let's go on to Lebanon, because we're going to cover a lot of international in the first half hour. Evidently, the Lebanese tribunal has convicted two people in the 2005 assassination of Rafiq Hariri. It seems that appeal judges at the Lebanon tribunal on Thursday convicted another two men of several counts of terrorism and murder for playing a role in the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, reversing an earlier acquittal. The appeals chamber had unanimously decided to reverse the acquittals. We unanimously find Mr. Hassan Habib Mehri and Hussein Hassan Onaisi guilty. Presiding Judge Ivana, I can't pronounce his name correctly, her name is Ivana Rydlikova, sounds like it could be Russian or Ukrainian, said in a summary of the judgment read out in court. Now, the prosecution had appealed against the acquittal of the two men, saying there had been fundamental errors in the judgment. In 2020, a lower trial chamber already convicted a former member of the Shiite movement Hezbollah, Salim Jamil Ayash, for the bombing that killed veteran Sunni Muslim politician Hariri. Now, all three men have been tried in absentia and remain at large. A huge blast on February 14 of 2005 killed Hariri and 21 others and injured 226. The bomb left an 11-meter, that's a 33-foot-wide crater. Hariri's assassination plunged Lebanon into what was then its worst crisis since 1975 to 1990 civil war, setting the stage for years of confrontation between rival political forces. Well, the attack triggered mass protests that drove Syrian forces out of Lebanon after three decades, and Hariri had opposed the Syrian presence in Lebanon. So a lot of stuff is going on all around the world, which is really mind-boggling. You know, we need to know this sort of stuff. Anyway, Macron, the French prime minister, is hosting European Union leaders for Ukraine crisis talk or talks in Versailles. So European Union leaders gathered at Versailles for a two-day summit starting today on how to address Russia's invasion of Ukraine amid calls for Kyiv for a fast-tracked path to membership in the European bloc. European Union leaders will scramble on Thursday to find ways to urgently address the fallout of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and carefully tell Kyiv that joining the bloc remains years away. Now, the meeting of the Versailles Palace was set to be the high point of France's six-month European Union presidency, but President Emmanuel Macron will instead spearhead a crisis summit to answer Russian leader Vladimir Putin's brutal disruption to decades of stability in Europe. Well, the Ukraine war and the European Union's energy supply. We'll dominate the two-day meeting with leaders sitting down for dinner at the palace's Hall of Mirrors, where Western allies carved out a new map of Europe in 1919 after World War I. Well, Russia's war of aggression constitutes a tectonic shift in Europe's history, a draft of the two-day meeting's final declaration had said. The leaders will grasp, quote, how the European Union can live up to its responsibilities in this new reality, protecting our citizens, values, democracies, and our European model. Well, the 27 heads of state and government meet as fighting raged for a 15th day in Ukraine, with more than 2 million refugees escaping mainly to Poland, but also to countries across Europe. I think Poland has taken over a million, and the rest went to other parts of Europe and the Middle East. Well, the heart-wrenching conflict has been a swell of support in the European Union for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. But leaders were expected to use the talks to reiterate that a fast-tracked membership to the Union was impossible. Quote, we want to express moral support for President Zelensky and to show they are part of the European family, end quote, a senior European Union diplomat involved in preparing the summit told reporters. Quote, but let's not start a process that will take years and find ways to really help Ukraine in the near term, the diplomat added. And then there are big issues. Even before the war, Macron's ambition for the summit in France, in France's most august setting, was to lay down a path to strengthen Europe's stature on the world stage. The issue took a more dire turn with Russia's war on the block, on the bloc's eastern edge, and leaders were to explore ways to shore up Europe's self-reliance in a starkly more dangerous world, especially in energy. I think energy is the biggest issue on leaders' minds right now, said a European source with close knowledge of the matter. The conflict has seen energy prices skyrocket, threatened the economy, and sparked a pressing discussion on where Europeans can turn for gas and oil. The European Union imports about 40% of its natural gas from Russia, with Germany, Europe's biggest economy, especially dependent on the energy flow along with Italy and several central European countries. About a quarter of the European Union oil, European Union's oil imports also come from Russia. Europe's dependency on Russian energy even caused the first crack in the West's unified response to Putin's aggression, with the European Union this week shying away from a ban on Russian oil imports implemented by the United States and Britain. So according to the meeting's final declaration, the 27 leaders will cautiously agree to, quote, phase out, end quote, the bloc's dependency on Russian oil, gas, and coal. Well, the European Union leaders will also try to advance on ways Europe can gain independence in highly sensitive sectors, including semiconductors, food production, and most notably, defense. Collective security in the European Union is primarily handled by the U.S.-led NATO alliance, but France, the European Union's biggest military power, would like the bloc to play a bigger role. Since Russia's belligerence against its pro-European Union neighbor, bloc members have approved a total of €500 million in defense aid to Ukraine. Berlin dramatically broke with long-standing doctrine when it announced it will plow €100 billion into national defense. In view of the challenges, we must, quote, resolutely invest more and better in defense capabilities and innovative technologies, end quote, the leaders were expected to say. So that is like a major, major issue. And this is really very interesting. This is an exclusive. One second, where did I have it? That was written. One second, not see where I lost my place here. So we'll find it in a moment. Bear with me a second. Oh, where is this here? Okay, let me go back and see where and how I lost this issue. Okay, let me see if I can find it. Where is it? One second. One moment. All right, I'm still looking for it. I'm sorry about that. What a delay. One second. Okay, I don't know where that is. I misplaced it. Maybe I'll find it for you by tomorrow. Well, evidently the Ukraine war has brought Sweden and Finland ever closer to NATO. It seems that the Russian invasion of Ukraine has upended the status quo in traditionally non-aligned Finland and Sweden, ushering in an historic surge in support for NATO, exceptional arms exports, and defiance to Moscow's demands. Stockholm, the capital of Sweden, and Helsinki, the capital of Finland, have ruled out applying to join the NATO military alliance for the time being, but the two countries have never been so close to taking the plunge, analysts say. Quote, anything is possible at the moment, and the signal from NATO countries is that a membership application can be processed in a very short time span, said Zubulon Kalander, a defense analyst with the Society and Defense Organization in Sweden. So I think it's very much a political decision that rests in the capitals of Stockholm and Helsinki. Well, the two countries are officially non-aligned, although they have been NATO partners since the mid-1990s and ended their neutral stance at the end of the Cold War. Finland's Prime Minister Sanna Marin said on Tuesday that the mindset of citizens and politicians towards joining the alliance is changing, quote-unquote, following Russia's assault on Ukraine. The NATO debate is in full swing and will certainly intensify, Marin had said, after party leaders led to consider how to respond to a public petition calling for a referendum on NATO membership. But Marin cautioned against drawing conclusions at this stage. The petition garnered 50,000 signatures needed to refer the matter to the parliament in less than a week and will be considered as part of a wider debate on the Ukraine crisis. For the first time, a majority of 53% of Finns are in favor of joining NATO, according to a poll published on Monday by public broadcaster YLE. That is almost double the number a month ago when Helsingin Sanomat newspaper put support at just 28%. And this is a completely historic and exceptional result. Sali Salonius Pasternak of the Finnish Institute of International Affairs had said, support for joining NATO is historically high in Sweden too, 41%, according to a poll by public broadcaster SVT last Friday. In another radical change, the two countries have broken with tradition by exporting weapons to a country in active conflict. And Sweden is sending 5,000 anti-tank weapons to Ukraine alongside helmets and a body armor, while Finland is sending 2,500 assault rifles, ammunition, and 1,500 single-use anti-tank weapons. For Sweden, this is an unprecedented since the Winter War of 1939, when it sent assistance to Finland to counter an invasion by none other than the Soviet Union. And this is probably just the beginning of reassessments in Swedish defense security policy, Kalanda had said. Both countries are also seeing a surge in application for their army reserves, and experts expect the two countries to act in concert on whether to join NATO. If they did, it would further heighten tensions between Russia and the West, since the eastward expansion of the alliance is the prime security grievance of the Kremlin. Last Friday, Russia's foreign ministry warned that if the Nordic countries were to join NATO, it would, quote, have serious military and political repercussions, end quote. Helsinki shrugged this off as a warning it had heard before, which it certainly has. So let me move over to our next site. Bear with me a moment. Let me just see if we can get this in place. We move away from here. I've got to bring in Brian Harron because he's probably on the line already, but I haven't gotten there. Oh, there he is. Good morning.
Hi,
Mr. Harron. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. How are you doing?
All right. Well, thanks for hanging in there. Just barely made it. Thought I would miss you by a couple of seconds, but thank God it's okay. Well, the whole world
no,
is turning upside down. I don't know. Are we doing any better here locally?
I believe so. It's been rather quiet in Yonkers, but I was getting ready to say I was enjoying the article there from about the situation in the Ukraine. It's how can I say, Putin has really stepped into it. You know, he may eventually face some regime change over this. It's a serious miscalculation on his part. And when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, you know, it's little villages and hills, and it doesn't look like, you know, the major capitals of Eastern and Central Europe or in the Nordic communities, but as people are watching the horror of these cities being leveled by Russia, it's really going. And then the even Switzerland, you know, even Switzerland has kind of joined the chat, and they've gone along with all these sanctions and banking reforms. When they're when you've lost Switzerland in the financial markets, nobody gets more neutral than Switzerland. You know, it's all about the money there. So it's something else. Things are really changing rapidly on the ground. So I just don't. The other thing of it is, I think it even will have enough. Some people think it'll bring Russia and China closer, but I think it may cool China's jets because they see, you know, it's not so easy to pull off an invasion. Even when we went into some place like Kuwait, we spent months and months preparing. You know what I'm saying? It's a logistics nightmare. And China, they tried to invade. They had a dispute with Vietnam in the past, and it didn't go so well for them. They've been back and forth with the border with India. Not so great. They even took a couple of islands from Taiwan and got repelled, you know, decades ago. So maybe China might just be, you know, maybe this whole aggressive thing might just need to cool down a little bit, because the last thing they need is those kind of sanctions that Russia has. So.
Exactly. Very good points. No, that's great. There's no problem. I think that's wonderful. That's what this is. This is a discussion, right? It's not to muzzle anybody.
Hey, somehow or another, I'm sounding like a Cold War hawk, but it's just, I guess it's just as shocking now as when they rolled into Czechoslovakia, you know, when I was a very young child. But it's just, how can I say, it's amazing how much it's galvanized the world community. And now even taking, it's almost like an economic warfare now. You know, if you're going to be a bad actor, we don't necessarily have to send in, you know, the United Nations troops to try to restore order. We can just slow you down a little bit, you know, if you're a rogue state.
Well, it's interesting. It's 15 days of this war, quote unquote, and I'm just blown away. The Ukrainians are fighting for every inch, and trying to hold on, and they're being starved to death, and it's freezing, below freezing. Uh-huh. There's no water. There's no heat. There's no food. I don't know how they do it. The hospitals are being blown up with Russian artillery. Women, in the midst of giving birth, are being killed by these bombs. It's outrageous what's going on. I mean, who would have? This is not civility. I mean,
no.
I, I never heard of anything like these. Are atrocities that are absolutely mind-boggling. I would never even imagine to think this stuff up. I don't know where Putin gets this.
Well, he probably thought it was going to be, you know, you don't want World War II. We're going to go in here. I'm going to build up support locally. And if he could have actually pulled it off, but, you know, these tanks and stuff that didn't perform well. And as you say, the leadership of the Ukraine has been shockingly effective. Most everybody thought the Ukraine would be occupied by now within 15 days. But they have slowed this thing down, and the Russians are trying to pulverize it with missiles, but it's not doing them any favors long term. I think it's actually making it worse for them. So we'll see how she plays out. But it's had my attention more than most wars, because I've just been. It was something new every day, you know. So it's even the ship that pounded the island in the beginning on the first day of the war, that Snake Island. Apparently, the Ukrainians have sunk that thing. So it's they're son of a gun. These Ukrainians, they're not going down without a fight. They're exacting a great deal of punishment on the Russian forces.
Absolutely. Fascinating. Well, it's not that exciting here on this side of the Atlantic, but we've got a lot of things that are, you know, I don't know, very pertinent to us locally. I guess one of the biggest contests is the for the Assembly District 16, where you have Congressman Jamal Bowman, who's been his district's been redefined with new borders, which is going to bring new people with interest in the area. So it covers parts of the Bronx and Westchester County, including Yonkers and Mount Vernon, parts of Eastchester and New Rochelle, Harrison, North Castle, Bedford, Somers, Yorktown and Valley, and Carmel, and also in Putnam County. And there's so many people running. You know, there's this guy from Yorktown, Vedat Ghashi. He's a real estate attorney. And he's a Westchester County Board legislator, too. And he's filed papers. And Jamal Bowman, of course, he's running for re-election. Uh-huh. And there was even talk, as you pointed out, that the younger Democratic chairman, Tommy Meyer, was going to consider running for that seat as well. Uh-huh. Even Mayor Mike Spano was being considered. Yes. But they're not running. And then, there's this one guy, I don't remember, he is from New Rochelle. You pointed that out, but I don't remember about his ethnicity, even though he has a name that I guess evokes a Hispanic background, a name like Manuel Casanova.
Yes.
Maybe he's a little bit Italian and maybe a little Hispanic. When I hear Casanova, I only think of an Italian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, not a pox on anybody.
I'm not that familiar with him also.
Heritage.
But he was first out of the gate wanting to challenge Mr. Bowman. Yeah.
Yeah, but is he Hispanic or not? Not that it
I'm
matters.
I'm not that familiar with him, honestly. Maybe they know him pretty well around New Rochelle, but I do recall he made substantial headlines when he was kind of like I said, the first out of the gate to challenge him, like last fall. You know what I'm saying? But as far as the campaign or having events or fundraising or whatever, I assume he's collecting his signatures. I really don't know much about him. I guess the mayor and Mr. Meyer did the math and tried to do the calculations if they could pull off a good campaign against Mr. Bowman, and I guess in the end they decided it wouldn't work out.
I don't think
out.
It's Mr.
And,
Bowman that dissuaded them from running. I think it was just subterfuge. They wanted to, both of them wanted to make believe that they were running for office so that there wouldn't be consideration that the mayor might run for another office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, conceivably even a fourth four-year term. And I don't know about Tommy Meyer. I never hear anything from him. from year in or year out. And I don't think I've even heard from him three times in the last 12 years. Maybe you have, but I don't.
And no,
he's not in touch
with
anybody that,
that
I know
that
of.
Democratic committee. He, I don't know. Mr. Bowman, he has definitely has a target on his back, and this district being pushed north is you couldn't get a more diverse district from you know, kind of like far right people in Putnam County to moderate Democrats to very progressive Democrats. So and just regular Republicans in between in the middle county here. So it's going to be a challenge for him. I assume he's going to play strongly to his base in lower Westchester. And the candidate, I guess, like you say, the strongest one or the most viable, the gentleman from Yorktown, he does have experience, and he does have wealth, and he's on a winning streak. He won his last election pretty handily, so
I think he seems the most plausible. I think he can somehow eclipse a lot of different perspectives, so he can satisfy a lot of different political perspectives better than someone like Bowman, who seems to cause some people to bristle and other people to celebrate him. It's hard to tell where he's from. He's also like what is he, like the sixth member of the squad. And I'm wondering if, you know, that whole concept is waning. It may have been, you know, something special 4 years ago with Ocasio-Cortez, but it's starting to lose its juice. Or do you think it's still holding on? And I don't know why it became so important or why it's lessened in value now.
Well, one thing I'll say, they're very adept at getting publicity and getting attention. And the same people that helped get these people elected will probably be helping Mr. Bowman. This could be a very ugly campaign going forward. And there's, like you say, there's a lot of people that dislike Mr. Bowman, you know, from conservative and other media outlets. And you also have some issues that Mr. Bowman brings up that are, you know, are many families can benefit from. So there is some appreciation of some of his issues, but he's kind of like the gentleman in New Rochelle. He's kind of an unknown quantity in Yonkers. It's not that he's very active in Yonkers. You don't really see him around. So it's hard, but
if he doesn't want to talk,
Medicaid
he doesn't
for
communicate
all.
With Yonkers.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I find offensive. If you're running for political office, it doesn't matter whether you're running in Yonkers or not, but if you're running in this area, why these candidates don't reach out to everybody in the area, blanket the whole thing. The message should not be that much different in Yonkers or Mount Vernon or New Rochelle or even in Yorktown. What's the difference?
Yes.
Can't you speak to all different aspects of society in all these places? And why their silence is beyond me, because that's what undermines them. That's what undermines their lack of winning.
Yes.
Remember Mr. Pinion who ran for office?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but I never heard from him while he was running.
Yeah.
Never heard a thing from him.
Well, you know,
I would have given him the time of day. I mean, he's a candidate.
I think part of the problem is the media landscape has been rapidly changing over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And there are some people who get it, who understand it, who understand demographics and do quite well in elections. And there are some people who cling to the old ways and are looking for yard signs and palm cards. And they're becoming less and less and less effective. And I think
that's
over time,
the way of trying to reach
see,
out. That's not the way to reach out to anybody today. You got to be
out
of your mind if
saying.
You're putting something in print.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
or
ridiculous.
Or even trying to buy a massive cable TV buy on the last day of the election when everybody's made up their minds. That used to be kind of
a waste of time.
These things aren't viable anymore. Or buying a print ad in a newspaper just isn't as viable as it used to be. And some people get it, some people understand it, and they're very successful. You've seen that in local elections. We've had some upsets here in Yonkers.
Who's been successful?
I would give Zahi Karras has been very smart about understanding demographics, understanding the new media, and understanding how to run a modern campaign.
Don't go on, but Zahi Karras is not a candidate. He is a...
No, I'm saying it's people that manage candidates or...
He learns how to get the message out, but he doesn't deny the message reaching Democrats, Republicans, and anybody in between or on the margins, because the message is what's going to propel a candidate to be recognized or denied a recognition. Mm-hmm. But it's not handing out palm cards. The thing that people resent about Zahi Karras is the fact that he's outwitted every one of these experts who are still living 40 years back. And he's here. He's now. Mm-hmm. And that's what offends people. They're jealous. They're jealous.
But, some people get that there's a new media landscape, and some people don't understand there's a new media landscape. And the ones that get it are finding themselves to be more successful. So let's say in this election, if this gentleman from New Rochelle or the gentleman from up in Yorktown or Mr. Bowman just try to run a traditional campaign, they might not be as successful. But, you know, it's even now in the new media, it's very easy to frame your opponent, you know, to get your message out while he's using less effective means. And if you both aren't in the new media, one's at a much a greater disadvantage, in my opinion.
It's not an opinion; it's a fact.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't be taking out ads, for example, in a print newspaper that not everyone reads.
Yeah.
And you can't maintain your outreach only in English, because we have so many people of different ethnicities and who speak different languages. And it's not that they don't understand English, but they may not understand the nuance. So you need to be able to, you know, reach out to people in Spanish and in maybe in French or whatever, you know, but it's got to get done. And it's impossible, you know, to send out, they'll ask you, well, what's your background? Oh, that's your background? Wait a minute. Let me see which one of these palm cards I can give you so you can understand the new one.
There's garages all over Yonkers that have cases and cases of unused palm cards. But they seem to go for that, the yard signs. And I'm not going to say I don't notice a yard sign as I drive down the road, but it doesn't tell me much, you know, except the person's name. And the idea of I'm going to go into a polling station, and I don't know who any of these people are, and, oh, that name looks familiar, and click on it, is just maybe that was true,
absurd.
You know, in the past in very illiterate times, but nowadays people understand local issues much more. They're more engaged. They comment about it. They're on social media. They're looking at the new media. And they have an idea of what they want to accomplish. Now, if you're going to reach out to them on their preferred platforms and their preferred methods, then you're going to be more successful. But if you're going to be worried about, I don't know, the Journal News, the News 12, and whatever, you know, palm cards and signs, I'm not saying those aren't important, but they're less important, much less important than they used to be, you know. And so it's wise to
I think what people don't realize,
media,
you did,
it's a
you
biased
touch
opinion,
on it,
I'm in the new media,
when you
but
put up a sign on your lawn, it is a one-way, it's not a conversation. It's just a message that goes either understood or not understood. But the new medium, and I don't want to sound like I'm promoting anything because I'm not promoting anything. You know, if people want to engage us, well, that's fine. But if they don't, that's fine too. I couldn't care less one way or the other. But what I do know is that what you do and what I do is interactive. because people can comment. So they could say, well, they don't like the sign, or they do like the sign, or they tell you why they like the sign, and you get validation and you get gravitas.
Uh-huh.
You get nothing when you see somebody put up a sign in front of their lawn. So does it matter that Joe Blow is supporting this one or that one? Maybe you don't like Joe Blow.
Uh-huh. And I'll tell you, I'll put it this way. Just take a previous election. You had a lot of interest with the county clerk's race. And,
uh-huh.
You know, the lady was here in Yonkers. She insisted on buying four-color signs with her picture on it and dropping them on the highway outside of Rye Brook or Cortland,
mm-hmm.
or wherever. And some people didn't know who she was or what she was, but all that money she spent there, she would have invested it locally around her base in Lower Westchester on the new media. She might have made that 900 so votes that she needed to get a substantial win. And you know,
the other aspect of that is that she had an effective mean to some extent, but she spent too much money in the old methodology of reaching out. But
the real
Jahi Jarrus managed her campaign, but she didn't listen to him. And more importantly, she was lazy. She never got out there.
And
she was ineffective
in
her speech pattern as well. She doesn't know how to talk, and she should have looked at a mirror and spoken to herself and see if it made any sense, because she's like a ditz brain. And that doesn't mean she's a bad person, but you can't believe people like that. You need someone who's been able to spit out a message. And you've got to be out there.
I'll put it to
you
this way.
Advertising doesn't sell.
The thing that irritates me the most is when I have to listen to somebody after an election. And, you know, people want to try to explain things, but, oh, it was close. He did better than we thought. It was this, that, or another. And, you know, but he didn't use all the available tools. And the rule is, if you don't win, you don't govern. You know what I'm saying? The whole idea is to govern and to make an effect that you think that the community or your supporters need. And I hate to hear this stuff. Well, he got within 300, or they got within 900, or it was close, or nobody expected him even. Well, who cares? You know, if you don't use all the tools available and use them effectively, it's just an exercise of futility, because you have to win the thing if you want to govern. And if you want to win, you're going to have to be in the new media, and you're going to have to educate yourself about demographics and the way a campaign is ran in the 21st century, and forget about what they did in the 20th century.
Exactly. Well, that's very prudent, and it's not a soapbox because most people don't recognize it. They think that some of the old standards are appropriate. They don't work. And they don't work because, number one, you've got to be out there and you've got to reach out to people. You can't be hiding out. You can't be lazy. Every moment you have, if you're not eating or sleeping, or doing whatever else you've got to do, your responsibilities at work, you've got to be out there. And if you're not, you're not going to make it.
Yes.
Because the other person is. The one who works harder is going to win. And if they win, you lost. And it doesn't matter if it's by one vote.
Even though the one who works smarter, you're just understanding. I think there's a lot of, there is an excuse in the things have changed and shifted very rapidly in less than a decade. So, and it takes a couple elections to see, look what happened. But, you know, fool me once, fool me twice kind of thing. It's time to wake up to what the new reality is. You know, when television first came on, some people jumped into it, some people didn't. And the ones that did were very successful at that time, you know, but that was decades ago. Same with radio. Same with maybe print advertising 100 years ago. Now you have a new medium, a new dimension, a new way that people prefer to communicate. And the people that get in on that and use it are the ones that are going to be more successful.
Yeah. So it's going to be very interesting to see with this new cadre of people running for different political offices what
uh-huh.
they believe is the most pertinent aspect of their candidacy. Like, for example, Mr. Pinion, who is a Republican, he's going to be challenging Chuck Schumer, who's the senator,
uh-huh.
and he's a majority leader. But the uh-huh. question is, who is going to win the hearts and minds of the people? Is it the political dogma that is running under the guise of these individuals? So is Mr. Pinion going to be the Republican? Is he going to be also independent? Meaning the independents that are out there, because you've got independents
mm-hmm.
and you've got Republicans and you've got conservatives, they have to be aligned in order to have some sort of an opportunity against the Democrats right now.
Mm-hmm.
How do they bridge that divide? So what are we voting for? Are we voting for ethnicity, for religion, for color, for what? What are we voting for?
All of them. I know Mr. Schumer with the conservatives and a lot of conservative cable broadcasters has a target
uh-huh.
on his back. He's him and Nancy Pelosi are like enemies number one and two or what have you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that will benefit Mr. Pinion with some money outside of New York. But and
uh-huh.
Mr. Pinion is. Not for nothing, he's very astute in a lot of ways. We're just outside the media capital of the world, New York City, you know what I'm saying? And he made himself marketable and available to multiple cable news outlets, from CNN to Fox News to Newsmax, and even parlayed that into a weekend show just because, I can hop on a train, I can be in your studio in 30 minutes when an issue breaks, and have an opposing opinion or an unexpected opinion. And he's very savvy. So, who knows how elections will turn out, but right now it looks like it's pretty much all Mr. Schumer's. There's probably a lot of support upstate, in more conservative areas for Mr. Pinion, but I like Chuck Schumer a great deal, and I think he's been good for our community, but there are others that have just, I don't know how to describe it, just have almost a drummed up hatred against Mr. Schumer.
Mm. Well, quite often the problem in the politicians that we have is that they also are living in an old world. They're not young. It's not like
mm-hmm.
they're a 30-year-old or 40-year-old or even 50-year-old. They're
mm-hmm.
in their 70s. That's old because they don't fully comprehend even the media outlets that are out there.
Uh-huh.
And I think that they're still stuck in trying to reach out to their base when the base is important, however you define the base in TV and radio and new media.
Uh-huh.
But you also have to reach out to those people that you think are not with you. But if you have a salient point to make
uh-huh.
that's credible, it might convince people that you thought weren't part of your little corral. And that's
uh-huh.
the problem. And the Democrats are horrendous at this. They just don't
uh-huh.
know how to reach the message or to send the message out there. I think the Republicans are much smarter about it. Or maybe they're just
more unified. Their message often is more unified when they you get their talking points and everybody kind of sticks to it. But when you get Democrats, they're all over the map, and they're more likely to attack another Democrat than to attack the opposition, the loyal opposition, I guess.
Crazy world.
But
so
I would underestimate Mr. Schumer. He's even though he's an older gentleman, you got to get up very early in the morning to outsmart him.
I'm not disregarding him. He just is what it is. But I think that the Democrats, including Mr. Schumer, have to do a better job of getting people to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. Quite often, these politicians speak over our heads thinking that they're so smart, but they're not. Because mm-hmm. by speaking over our heads and our ability to understand, because we don't comprehend the complexity of the issues they want to bring forward, they lose us. And eventually mm-hmm. you do that often enough, and people say, I don't care. I don't care what they got
yeah.
to say, because it doesn't matter to me, because I don't know what the hell they're talking about, and they don't want to explain it to me. They just
mm-hmm.
want to sound like they're smart, but they're not smart, because they're not mm-hmm. connecting. And that's the problem. So our politicians have created a schism between the politicians' world and the people that they hope will vote for them. And that's a major disconnect. And I don't know when we're going to get over that. And what's going to happen with the divide between the independents, conservatives, and the Republicans?
Well, as I said before, even some of the most radical parts of the Republican Party and the mainstream Republican Party, they seem to talk more with a unified message or are less likely to attack each other. But if you get the progressive wing of the Democratic Party or the mainstream Democrats, it's almost a battle between them. What we were talking before, where Mr. Meyer or the gentleman from Yorktown or the mayor, they were saying that, you know, I'm a moderate Democrat opposed to these progressives. So I have to, like I say, it seems somehow or another the Republicans and conservatives and what some people would call independents seem to speak with one voice or one set of, I guess, talking points is the word I'm looking for. They do a much better job of communicating
where we go. Yeah, I'm going to look forward to see how all these different disparate groups are going to get together, if they get together, or they
uh-huh.
they stay separate in the next elections. It's going to be very interesting. Because in a sense, we've got Republicans, we've got Democrats, we've got independents, and we've got, I guess that's it, right? It's all four, you know, and I wonder how it's going to lay out. It'll be very interesting how that comes out. So one of the big races that's coming up I never expected it, but it turns out that Mike Breen is going to announce on Saturday that he's running for the New York State Assembly member
yes.
seat representing the 90th district, which is presently the incumbent is Nader Sayers. And, you know, I don't know. Well, you know, one thing for sure that Breen is in the middle, has got 1 year left to his, is it 1 year or 2 years? No, I just think it's got 2 years left in his 4 year term. And so he's taking an opportunity to run for the assembly seat, and if he loses, you know, he still has his job. If he wins, then that seat, he gives up that seat, and then I think it's the mayor that is able to designate a replacement for him on the city council, right?
I believe so, yes, the appointment.
Okay, so it's going to be very interesting to see what happens and how that goes. So we'll see.
You know,
very
actually, I thought these races were going to be rather sedate and quiet, and I was actually complaining that there's not going to be much news. But then all of a sudden, now that they started collecting signatures in March, you're seeing these matchups, 2, 3, 4, you know, people per seat. So I guess just people saw the opportunities, and I assume Mr. Breen saw the success from say James Nolan and Mr. Maranti with the Republican Party. So I assume he figured he has a shot here against Nader.
I think, you know, with Nolan is an anomaly. Nolan was out there, you know, campaigning, but the reason he won is because the mayor of Bronxville, because he represents part of Bronxville and part of Yonkers, she's a Republican, and she was very vocal and wanted him there, even though at the end, they're only with him, with Mr. Nolan, there's only one other who's a Republican in a West County Board of Legislators, which I think they number 13 altogether. He's never going to be able to win a vote. However, and he didn't win on his own. He may have worked hard, which is not the problem, and I'm glad that he did. But so he had the support of the mayor in Bronxville, very well liked and respected. I don't know how many years he's been there, but over 10 years for sure. And then also the incumbent, the first term incumbent, she was a disaster. People hated her. They absolutely hated her. And then I remember writing a story about her where her conduct was outrageous. She didn't pay the Democratic chairman of the of Mount Vernon his son's ability to collect signatures on her behalf. He didn't pay her. And what she did was she ended up saying, she spoke to Reggie Lafayette, who's unfortunately recently died in the last few months, and he calls her up and he says, hey, you haven't paid my son. What's going on here? He says, oh, it was an oversight. He says, send him over and I'll pay him. So he goes over to her house, and then she picks up the phone and calls the police and says, there's a black man in front of my door, and he's scaring the who knows what out of me. She knew who he was. And then I wrote the story.
Yes.
Destroyed her. So the bottom line is, and mind you, I wrote it before, actually. I wrote it, I think it was 2 years earlier, about that incident as
well. No, it was a big issue in the campaign. People brought it up a great deal, yes.
At the end, that was the thing that made a difference. So anyway, she's gone now, and this is the thing that blows my mind. Did you ever realize that this lady who's got a cheese store in Bronxville, and a very well-educated, I think she's from Yale or Harvard, a graduate, hated by everyone, and she didn't abide by the law because she wanted people to demonstrate in front of the Bronxville City Hall, and she was stopped by the police. She said, because she was told, hey, you've got to get a permit. You can't just show up. You have to have a permit. We have to give it to you, so you have to apply for it. Well, she never did, and they put an end to her. But since she lost to Mr. Nolan, you know, what's fascinating is that she's now become, are you sitting down for this one? She's supposed to be the czar of internet technology in the cyber world. And she got a job from, of all people, George Latimer. He was employing her as an expert in cyber technology. I never knew she knew anything about that. When did she get
the
expertise
used,
on this?
Her insights into the cyber world to get her message out to people. She was actually she took her incumbency for granted. And what we were talking about before, she was kind of playing that game, you know, you don't do nothing until after Labor Day, and then you start doing these traditional things, and then maybe try to have a little October surprise and just a week before the election. And she got her can kicked. And there were issues, like you said, that had been brought up about her. But she was very poor at getting her message out on Mr. Nolan, and Mr. Nolan did an exceptional job on her. And to Mr. Nolan's credit, you know, he did have a good ground game. He reached out to the unions, and they got, you know, he had that type of support, and he made sure he was on digital media, the new media, strongly, and had his name on people's phones every single day, multiple times, and it paid off for him. And I think he actually, in my opinion, pulled some other people up with him. And Mr. Morantes
campaign at that time about these weekly videos and being on new media also, I think, was there. And I think both of these things have kind of encouraged people like Mr. Green. And we'll see how it goes. But Nader's a very savvy person, so I don't know. There's a long time till November, so we'll see how it plays out. But
yeah,
I just never see Mr. Green on the new media. Let me put it that way. So
I don't see
him
anywhere.
He's more of a traditional
actually.
Type of candidate. Yeah.
Very, very traditional. So
yeah, I get
we'll see. Who knows? Maybe that's
him.
his raison d'etre. Maybe that's how he thinks he's going to win. I have no clue.
Uh-huh.
So it'll be very interesting to see where that goes. We'll just have to see.
Yeah, maybe he'll
anyway,
surprise us
there
and
are
become
challenges,
the new,
I think, for
the new internet czar like Ruth Walter here all of a sudden. But right now it doesn't look like he has much of an interest or presence on new media outlets or understand them that well.
Who's this?
Mr. Breen.
Oh yeah, I don't see it. But
yeah, it's very valuable to you know if somebody's on your website and they're looking at it on their phone. Mm-hmm. It's very important to get on people's phones. That's how they get their information. You can't people
right.
are not coming home to sit down in front of the I don't know what is it 5 or 6 o'clock news or whatever they call it. You know
mm-hmm.
people are not running down to the local, well, you can't find a local lottery store, cigar store, I guess, to buy a copy
mm-hmm.
of the Journal News. It's just not how people like to get their news. And if you don't like to deliver the news in the way that people like to receive it, you're at a severe disadvantage.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, now people are not expecting to get a delivery of the newspaper. And
uh-huh.
you'll read it then, because if they don't read it in the morning, it's completely different news in the afternoon. And
uh-huh.
so you've got to be on social media or on media that constantly updates in
uh-huh.
order for it to be valid. And you want to do it when you have the time, not when whoever the media outlet is has the time. And that's very, very important. And that's part
of
the interaction.
One thing I've noticed is... and you might notice it, too. There are certain times of the day and that traffic increases greatly for me, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And it's different even
right.
for social media, for the website, or what have you. And people like
right.
to get their information to them. It's often pushed to them nowadays with the new media, but they
mm-hmm.
have certain times to read it. A good time often is 10 o'clock in the morning. People are getting their first break from work, and they like to get on their phones, you know. Oftentimes,
exactly.
It's when it's convenient for them. Some people have odd working shifts, you know what I'm saying? And or maybe they're in the gig economy, you know, that type of thing. But these people they like to get their news when they have time. They don't want to wait and try to see a show. Even now, nobody says, "Oh my God, I got to get home by 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock tonight because I want to watch this movie." No, it's on demand.
Mm.
You know, and the news is on demand in the new media, and that's why it's so successful. And it's on people's phones. And
absolutely.
But yard signs are not on people's phones. Pound cards are not on people's phones. The Journal News really isn't on people's phones either. When you log onto the Journal News site with your phone, you're being hit up for some money. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Sign up for 3 months or something. So,
I've been deficient, and I didn't realize it because got stuck on, I guess, all this politics. But you came up with some really interesting concepts. One was that workers at Target are going to be earning as much as $24 an hour. When did this come about? Because I didn't hear about it, which doesn't mean anything. I mean, you know, you hear mm-hmm. things, I hear things. It's not a question of, but I didn't see that they were promoting it. This is a very unusual situation, isn't it? Because a lot of places don't even make $15 an hour.
Yeah. Well,
what's driving them to do this? Do we know?
Nationally, Target and a couple of big retailers like Costco and stuff have been saying they're moving to $20 or $20+ an hour. And since they're getting
Costco
ready to open
one. Costco is doing that too?
Even now, I think the minimum wage in New York is, I want to say 17. And, you know, it's about 30% more than the minimum wage. But especially in areas like ours that you need to a high standard of living, just to rent a small apartment, it's more needed than in, say, in other rural areas. And plus, there's a little bit of labor
shortage. Brian, you know what? You can't make a living on $15 an hour and pay your rent.
Mm-hmm.
$24 an hour, if you're working a 40-hour week, is what, 480? That's $960. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
$960, you could probably get an apartment
mm-hmm.
in that range, 1,000, maybe even 1,200. So it's a little bit more than 25% of your monthly income.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good place to be.
Yeah.
You know, that you shouldn't be spending more than 25%.
Mm-hmm.
That was the old standard. I don't know what the new standard is. But the point is, we don't need to be selling items or get people. A lot of people at Target or any other stores like that, they're not interested. They're just earning a living, but they have no interest to do anything special there. They're not. They don't get involved because they're not earning enough money.
Mm-hmm. And I'll
put
it this way, Hezzy. There's a myth that we can't afford to pay a living wage. You've seen that that the minimum wage has been raised a couple times during this pandemic. You've seen that. Places like Target now are even offering more money than they normally would above minimum wage to attract people. And all these companies are setting record profits. There's always this thing like, oh, if you pay a guy at McDonald's an extra $3 an hour, that all of a sudden your Big Mac's going to double in price. That is not the facts on the ground. And to be quite honest, we don't have a good immigration policy to fill the jobs that need to be filled. We're at 4%, a little under 4%, I think, in some areas of employment. When I went to school and college, 4% unemployment was called full employment because, you know, you have people
mm-hmm.
that just can't work. You know, they're able-bodied, but they couldn't work because of maybe childcare or other issues or maybe
mm-hmm.
I'm a student, I need to do part-time, whatever it was. But at 4%, we're at full employment right now. It's not that people don't want to
mm-hmm.
work, and it's just that people are moving into better job opportunities because there's a labor shortage. But
right.
the trick is, you years ago, maybe you were like the Spanos. You had a lot of kids, you know what I'm saying? But I had two kids. Now some people only have one kid, you know, or no children. Yeah, both of my boys have not produced offspring yet, you know what I'm saying? And they're getting older.
Mm-hmm.
So they're waiting longer and they're having less kids. And we're going to end up like Japan as they were, I guess, a couple decades ago, where they just couldn't replenish the population enough to grow. And
mm-hmm.
luckily, a lot of people want to come to America, but unfortunately, we don't make it a smart and easy way so that these jobs can be filled. And that's just my opinion, but I think it's based in economic fact. If you have a million some jobs going untaken, it's not because people don't want to work. There aren't people to fill them.
There are people to fill them, but people can't take a job for under $15 an hour and think that
uh-huh.
that is the right of a corporate structure to only employ people at those rates. So what that tells me, if Target is paying as much as $24 an hour, they don't have people who are willing to take the job at $15 or $12 an hour.
Uh-huh.
And because they waited so long, the companies are losing money because they can't meet the demand, and people are still,
uh-huh.
there are people who can afford, but you have to service them. You need tellers and you need people to stock up, and but they got to get paid a living wage. And that's one of the problems. If people are not earning a living, they're out there taking drugs, robbing people, and doing all sorts of things because they have no means. And just so you know, do you know how much it would cost to for a fast food place like a McDonald's or a Burger King in order to pay all their workers $15 an hour? It would cost them 5 cents more per burger. You think anyone's not going to buy a hamburger from McDonald's or Burger King or wherever else you want if it costs 5 cents more? It's bullshit.
No,
it's the biggest lie out there.
That's economics.
I'm quoting you, an economist who's said this now for years, and I have him on every.
I agree.
Wednesday.
It's you know, it's just been a better, faster, cheaper world a little too long, and things sometimes the pendulum swings one way and it swings the other way, and you know they want to build in efficiencies, which is, people understand. But even today, if somebody works, I worked as I worked at a McDonald's years and years ago, about 40 some years ago when I was in school up in Albany, right? And the what people have to do now to what I had to do at that time is much different. You know, they're working three or four or five times much harder. And it's when I walk into one of these places, it looks like with even less staff. And and then you're asking them, like you say, to live at a subsistence level or a subpar level. Actually, when I worked going to school, there was some. I worked at a Rite Aid and a McDonald's, both part time. But those two part time jobs, I could maintain an apartment and go to school and eat. You know what I'm saying? But if you have two part time jobs now in this service industry at a local drugstore. At a local burger place, you can't keep a roof over your head. You barely could be able to feed yourself. So, and the job is harder than it used to be. And I get so tired of these restaurants to say we can't get servers, you know, that are on a tip income, because that's usually half of minimum wage, and your tips are supposed to make up the difference. You know what I'm saying? And then they say, well, why nobody's walking in the door to take this job? Well, you know what? They're finding other opportunities that pay three times as much as you're paying or more, you know. So it's less work in the process, you know. And it's just and I don't see any of these retail establishments going bust. They're celebrating record profits, you know what I'm saying? In the middle of a pandemic, they're celebrating record profits. And you can't tell me that they can't afford to properly compensate their staff.
They can afford. It's just that this is a misnomer that they've been promoting for the last 25 years. And it's sold because every corporate structure said, oh, yeah, I'd like to do that. I want to be able to sell a radiator for less money. So I'm not going to pay my employees the money that they deserve. And that's the way it went on. And corporate America should not be permitted to do that. And corporate America shouldn't even be able to export all the work that is done to create all these goods that we purchase. Because guess what? If we don't purchase them, who is?
Yeah.
Anybody else from Vietnam or Indonesia buy the sneakers for $250 a piece?
I'll put it this way. You know, people's opinions have to evolve over time, and as you get older, you start to understand things a little better. But when I was in late 20s, early 30s, I thought actually that importing these jobs overseas was the best thing for our economy, that we were kind of importing management, you know, that, you know, there was work in, we used to be Japan, and from Japan we went to Korea, to Taiwan, and we were going to China. And if China ever gave us any problem, we'll just move over to India. There's a billion people who speak English and understand the rule of law. And we shipped almost every factory job that we have over to China. And it created a national security risk for us, you know, that
oh, wait, you mean we can't get computers, we can't get this, we got to worry about this camera, that whatever it happens to be, especially in the area of certain things like electronics. All of our technological innovation, we just gave away because we wanted to have an extra 5% on our margin, or because we could ship all of the labor over to these other places. And now
more,
I think we're waking up to how foolish that was.
It wasn't 5%. It wasn't 5%. Get over that. I don't know where you've been hiding. It's not
a
5% difference between us making it or they're making it in China.
Yeah.
It's a fortune of money in percentages.
Well, probably so. But like everybody loves their iPhone, but the whole thing comes from China, and the whole technology is right there. In China. Yeah. So now it's well, you know what? This is a little bit of a risk. So it's we're kind of waking up to the foolishness of shipping all of our stuff to a country that might not have our best interests at heart. And
it's our government that gave subsidies to our firms made that were here and a resident here, and gave them a tax credit to move their operation overseas. So Vietnam, Indonesia, China, and so many other places have benefited, and we've not.
Uh-huh.
And our society is in a very bad way because of it. And hopefully things are changing. If they're going to be paying $24 an hour, I'm thrilled to pieces. And that's what people deserve, a little respect and some dignity so they can pay the rent and live a life and send their kids to school. That's what it's all about.
No, living wage will solve a lot of society's problems, in my opinion, if we start to move towards that.
Well, hopefully, if we get it together, we also need to bring back the technology that we are now producing abroad. You know, in Taiwan, they have the best chip makers in the world. It doesn't belong there because you know what, if China wants it, they'll take it at any moment. Just like Ukraine is being overwhelmed by Russia, China can come in, and what do we have? Then we got nothing, absolutely nothing. And you think that the Apple plant in China, their technology hasn't already been absconded with by the Chinese? You gotta be dumb to think that.
The good news is the trend is starting to reverse. So it's a big shift to get it to turn around 180 degrees. But I think people are realizing that it wasn't the wisest decision. Like I said, decades ago, during these years of and there were excesses on the other side of it. There were inefficiencies in corporations when you had these, the corporations like AT&T that owned everything from books to restaurants to telephones, what have you. And restructuring was necessary, but there were some things that could have been done overseas. But it got to the point to where, you know, stuff that's in our national security interests, like electronics and software. We sent it too. We sent the Hummer. We sold the Hummer to China. You know what I'm saying? GM sold the Hummer to China. We don't make the Hummer no more. So the armored vehicles that the U.S. government developed with GM now is that technology is right in China.
I guess we weren't very smart in those days.
Yeah.
So well, I still believe that America needs to confine itself to building itself before it builds everybody else. And it is America first. That's not a Donald Trump statement. It just is. If we fail, then we fail. And you know what? Nobody will be here to pick us up. And that's what's important. Because there's a great deal of animosity towards America's success.
Yeah.
And we need to hold on to it, and a lot of our people are just not getting by. You know, not everybody earns $5,000 a week.
Yeah. No, we've turned our economy into I think it's mostly a service economy. It's a service economy, and we went from the world's largest manufacturer to a service economy, and now we've got to kind of, like I say, right the ship and bring some of this back.
You know, normally we have the driving me crazy crowd in the morning from 10 to 10:30, and it was about a month and a half or maybe 2 months ago, the number one seller of cars in the United States was Toyota. The first time in over 90-some-odd years that General Motors was not the number one car manufacturer. Do you know how frightening that is?
It's a wake-up call, let me put it that way. Actually, I drive an old GM car, but if I look in the lot outside of my apartment building, it's very hard to find an American-made car. They might be manufactured here, but they're manufactured by a foreign corporation.
Yeah, that's very true.
The label.
We got to get our act together
the brand
somehow.
Is foreign in most cars here.
So, anything else that we need to talk about or should be talking about?
Well, we covered an awful lot there. It was almost like the political hour this time around, you know what I'm saying? But that's the season right now. So, and there's so many pressing issues with Ukraine, with the economy, and then with local elections that I guess politics will probably dominate the conversation for the next next few months, especially
in November
for the primaries.
So, but before you go, do you have any clue where Mike Spano, the mayor of the city of Yonkers, is going, or is he staying?
I don't know. I wish I
knew. I have no idea what he's doing.
I've confessed to this over and over, has he? And I guess I'll do it one more time. When he was going to run for this third term, he said no. I don't know how many times to the press. And I actually accused you of being a conspiracy theorist because you kept saying, no, my sources tell me he's running. My sources tell me he's running. My sources tell me he's running. And then son of a gun, in a week's time, he pulled the trigger and boom, 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 the votes were there. Boom, boom, boom. It was a done deal. And he was in for a fourth term. And it's not that third term. I'm not that I was even opposed to it. I actually think he's done a good job, but I have to say, who knows what's happening with the mayor? Will it be will he go on to another position, or will he go for the fourth term?
I think he's going to stay put. Just not to interrupt, but just to acknowledge, Ron Matten's on the line, so I guess he's waiting to talk. I'm not sure. You know, I'm losing my mind. How are you, Ron?
Good.
So are we supposed
how
to talk
you?
Today?
How are you, Brian? I heard you guys talking about, kind of import-export and the silicone chip industry, and I had a couple thoughts on that, as I have on just about everything. So I thought I'd chime in.
go for it, man.
silicone is relatively easy. It's relatively easy. We did send our chip manufacturing over to China. The harder thing, though, for us to come up with is the rare earth elements that are used in many, the rare earth metals that are used in many of the devices we have now. The largest supplier of rare earth metals is China. And when we talked about moving manufacturing a few years ago back to the United States, they threatened to cut us off from the rare earth metals market. We're probably the number two, have the number two deposits in the world for rare earth metals, but there's also some environmental problems with mining them. There are a couple of bills now to issue tax credits for those industries or those companies that want to mine. It's a lot to start up a factory. It takes a lot of capital, and once these factories close, it's hard to get them back because of that.
What about South America? Don't they have a lot of these special elements in South America? We haven't really explored very much there, have we?
They might.
Like lithium,
remember,
and so many other
mine
things.
Needs is still an environmental impact.
I see.
You know, just because whether China does it, we do it, or they do it, we're just exporting the problems with it. And I think we would be more responsible here in the United States environmentally because we do have regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So I think even though you're going to pay a little, look, top of the line iPhone is $1,200-$1,300. I think if somebody can afford $1,200-$1,300 for an iPhone, they've got no problem paying $1,400.
Right.
At the end of the day. There are other phones at other price points.
And I'll put this way, too. It's more of a national security risk that we've discovered. You know, there were some things, maybe, you know, importing the manufacture of clothes to Bangladesh or China or Central America was a wise decision, but importing technology and software we're starting to find out has potential security risks for our country.
Well, and it depends on the grade. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's chips out there, Brian, that we don't use and we don't know anything about because they're used in technologies that we don't need. I ordered, you know, my wife and I ordered a car in November. I'm told maybe it'll be built in August. I'm sorry, in April.
Oh, wow. April.
In April. And it's being built in Mexico.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't have the chips either.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not so concerned about the consumer market. It does affect, you know, I'm going to pay over sticker for the car. Because you basically have no choice. It's a scarce commodity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've seen this before, that there's been a temporary supply shortage, and we've seen people take advantage of prices in the past, and we've had downturns. This, I think, will turn around. And I also think that there was one benefit out of this out of COVID was we kind of woke up to the fact that maybe there's some industries that should be in the U.S. and there's some industries that we could allow to go overseas. And
sounds like eerily like Donald Trump.
It does somewhat. There's, you know, no one has a monopoly on truth. You know what I'm saying? Or
all right,
facts.
So he wasn't wrong about everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not a
both sides.
Either. I'm just saying. No, look, there are things I didn't like in the 90s when everything left the United States, because we did lose some good paying jobs. Not everybody, mm-hmm. not everybody's geared up to go to college,
mm-hmm.
and not everybody can afford to go to college. But and there are good trades out there. There's good, you know, Yonkers used to be a manufacturing capital. We had so
yes.
many things going on, you know, all the way dating back to Otis Elevator and the Alexander Carpet Mills, you know, moving
mm-hmm.
into the PVC Corporation was on Nepperhan. There was some metal chroming or metal plating
mm-hmm.
companies. We had a lot of industry in Yonkers that we don't seem to have anymore,
you know,
which is unfortunate.
As I confessed to Hezzy earlier, you know, back in when I was in the 20s and 30s, I was a strong advocate of you know, having a more efficient economy and pretty much what I would call back then exporting American management and expertise and having the assembly accomplished somewhere else. But like I say, over time you learn, you know, and then in this situation we learned that some industries are just too critical to export if we want to maintain a leading edge in the world economy, and
I think we found it
out pretty quickly.
Like when you do a car, for example, and like Ron is going to be buying a car, whatever it is, and it's going to be at a premium, that should be outlawed. There's no reason for that. That's just gouging. There's no reason why a used car that's 5 years old should now cost more than a new car. And that's because you're permitted to do that, and it should legally not be permitted. And you know what? The auto manufacturers are sick and tired of it because they're losing the respect of the consumer because of it. It's going to turn, but it could be done legally.
So there's a balance on pricing. You know, there's a fixed cost, Correct.
That you need, and then there's the variable cost for each additional unit that you sell. You know,
right.
On the fixed cost absorbs some of your variable costs, so that, you know, your last
mm-hmm.
unit sold is the cheapest cost to manufacture, but you still have fixed costs attached to it. So sometimes if you only sell 10 units, you still got to absorb the fixed costs in those 10 units versus the 20 units that you're selling. So some things, yes, some things.
Yeah, but that's all
nice,
challenging. But it's all gobbledygook, because at the end of the day, they have so many cars now that you could get paid more by selling it than you did when you bought it.
Oh, yeah.
How does that work?
Well, I get a notice from Mercedes every month that they want to buy back my
mm-hmm.
car. It's only a 2018, so I usually keep the car 10 years. And
uh-huh.
It's gone from 38,000 a year ago when they were started sending me these notices to about
48,000.
It's
okay.
About 42,000 now. That, you know, so it keeps
okay.
going up because, again, the Mercedes dealer needs to stay in business. So
uh-huh.
they're paying rent. They're
right.
paying for the lights. They're paying a minimal amount to the salesman, you know, before the commissions. And they need to get inventory. And there's no inventory.
And
right
I'll say this too. It's you know, I view these things as a temporary bump in the road. You know, some people, they see, you know, gas go up a little bit like it did a few years back, or something like this, and
it's
the end of the world.
It's up to $5 a gallon
but,
now. It's up to $5
say this,
a gallon.
They say the best cure for inflation is higher costs. People just buy less. They cut back. These supply issues slowly over time work their ways out. You
yeah,
know,
that's
we were having a heart attack in 2007, 2008 over gas. We were having a heart attack 7-8 years before that. But it balances out over time. And even with the vehicles, it's going to balance out. If you need a car right now, you're in a little bit of a tough situation. But if you don't, you can wait a year or two, then you can wait a year or two. But if you've got a kid going to college and he needs a car, and you want to help him, then you're stuck, you know. But if you're not in a rush to upgrade, or if you're in an auto accident, then I guess you're in a you're in a bind. You need to get a vehicle fast, or whatever your family situation is. But you're not going to see inflation go over and over and over for the next decade. You know, it's just something that's we've had some unique factors come together, and eventually it'll smooth out and settle down.
So, Brian, I'm going to disagree with that assessment just because
me too.
I don't know if you're around my age, but if
mm-hmm.
you lived through the 70s,
mm-hmm.
That inflation took around for a while. If you remember, the
I remember it. I was
with inflation.
I was in farm country in Missouri, but, you know, you had the Vietnam War came to an end, you know what I'm saying? And that would suck a lot of stuff out of the economy. And you had a lot of people coming back home to work, and that took a while to work out. And you had people, you know, like worried about, you know, the dollar matching gold and this, that, and another. So there were a lot of factors, just like now. There's a few factors coming in. This could it be between 7-8 years of bad times, potentially, but I honestly don't think it's going to manifest itself over that strong a thing. Unless there's a further outbreak of this pandemic or some other major tragedy, I see it smoothing out over time.
So I'm thinking it's going to be longer, and I'll tell you why. I'm looking at a slinky, you know, where you pull that spring, and then the rest has to catch up. So we've had just about two decades of low inflation. You know, folks who aren't our age don't know what it is to have 3% inflation, because we've had under 2
yeah.
over at least the last 12 years. Even in 2008, when we did have high gas prices, and things were not so great for those couple of years, inflation still maintained relatively low. They couldn't get the economy going, and the Fed had targeted 2% inflation rate, and they couldn't get past 1.75.
Uh-huh.
So where we are now is that pent up, it's kind of like
when you set a stick of dynamite on a trash can. Oh. It's gone. It blows up, and now it's really going to lift the lid on that trash can for a while because there's a lot of catch-up. Wages, I'll agree with both of you, wages have been artificially depressed over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's not the minimum wage law that did that. It's just that demand and increase in productivity over that time that we haven't had, you know, McDonald's now pays $15 an hour, maybe more, but you know what? They only have one cashier working because they've got, you know, six kiosks that you can order from in the store. So they've still managed to keep their wages down even with the higher wage rate, which eliminates jobs. So I think we're into a little bit of an inflation cycle now, and hopefully we're not into a stagflation cycle like we were in the 70s, and that was the issue with the 70s. Wasn't so much the inflation. It was that we had inflation, but the economy didn't grow. We didn't create jobs. We didn't create jobs with the higher inflation rate.
I would probably say this. It's a good analysis, but I would probably say it's overlooking some of the productivity gains. Some of the lower inflation rate came from, like you were mentioning before with the McDonald's, that workers are much more productive than they used to be, and businesses are more productive. So to expand, you didn't necessarily need to hire more people. Or even now, with the way, say, a McDonald's delivers food now, they don't need to open a second outlet or something in a community. But I would say that I think that there is definitely a demand for goods. I think we're almost at full employment, and I think that the temporary shortages are going to work themselves out. And I hope I'm right, but I could be wrong. But I have a feeling that give it 3 or 4 years, it's going to be a pretty good time, honestly.
Well, so when you're saying that we have productivity gains, that means we don't have to hire as many people. And when you're saying we're at full employment, which number are you using? Are you using U2 or U6?
Well, we're under 4%, you know, people who say they're out looking for a job, you know what I'm saying? And you got millions of jobs that just aren't being filled. And you do have very productive things. You take someone like Kezi, who operates an online newspaper. Before, that took a staff of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people. Kezi's kind of able to do it as a one-man operation. You have so many things now that don't require as many people, and we're much more of efficient operating within the economy, that I don't see any, a major conflict or a pandemic or something horrible happening, you know, a meteor hitting the planet. I see good times ahead. What's really working against us right now? Besides, you've got people that can't get enough goods. They've got so much demand that they're buying things hand over fist. You've got places making record profits. It's just that right now there's a disruption in the economy as far as it's overused, the supply chain, but it should be. I don't see any negative consequences ahead.
Well, you're
but aren't
more,
we still leaving a lot of people on? There are a lot of people that are suffering, and they never did well. They haven't done well for 10 years, and can we afford to wait another 4 years before these people are recognized as not doing well in the economy? Not everybody's making $5,000 a week.
Is that our population is aging so fast. Me, you, and Ron are getting older, and we need to put younger people underneath. I believe solving immigration a little bit better than we have would make a big improvement for our economy. But I wouldn't want to live any place else. I don't know any place else that would be more beneficial to me or my family or my offspring's future than to be here in the U.S. And I don't see it as doom and gloom that we are just sunk
You know, you've already had your best years. I don't think we've had our best years. I think the innovation and the things that are happening in this country are truly amazing, even as we speak.
So
I don't
disagree,
except that I don't know if – yeah, go ahead.
Just on the unemployment rate, when people – you've got to categorize that. So there's the U3 rate, which I think that that Brian is quoting, which is the current people who are unemployed, who are recent unemployed individuals. There's the U4 and U6 rates. The U4 rate is discouraged employees. And that's not as rosy as, you know, we would believe. That is still at the 2020 levels. It's not as high as the 2020 pandemic levels, but it's still as high as the 2020 levels. Then there's the U6 rate, which is actually not too bad. And those are the underemployed people, which are at about 8%. That's people who I couldn't get a job making my $125,000 that I made. So now I have a job making $75,000, and maybe I've added a part-time job to that. So those are all the different unemployment rates. And as he's correct, there are still people who are struggling. You know, I don't know whether it's for show or that there is that real need for the Westchester food bank that seems to be daily at Chicken Island. But, you know, that maybe I'm just jaded because I think there's – we didn't have that to this degree before.
Well, there is food insecurity in Yonkers and Westchester, and it's how can I say? You have you had Mitch McConnell the other day saying, the poor kids go, starve. We don't need free lunch programs in school. The other day, so there is there's any jadedness. It's on people who. Who don't seem to have compassion for some people who weren't born with the same hand of cards that they were born with and are having to play from a weaker position. But one thing I do appreciate is a lot of the technology and a lot of things that I'm praising, I think is going to be good for the economy, is leveling the playing field. And I do it would be foolish to say that in Yonkers,
yeah, you
where
level,
people could spend $1,800 for a one-bedroom apartment, might be food insecure, especially if you have children. That I don't think it's for show. I think it's a serious issue. Does Yonkers government run as efficiently as it could? Are taxes lower, which would make rents lower? No. But is Westchester well run? And if you go to a town like Rye Town, which has Rye Brook and Port Chester and unincorporated areas inside of it, it's very expensive. They've all got a police chief. They've all got a school superintendent. They've all got a village manager, what have you, plus the town government on top of it. But it's very inefficient how Westchester County is. If you go to Greenwich, and from Greenwich, Byram, Coscob, Riverside, Old Greenwich, Mianus, the backcountry, that town is much more efficiently run, and it doesn't need police chiefs. It doesn't need eight town managers.
But
they
have a police chief in Greenwich.
I'm saying they have one for all those communities, it's not like Port Chester, Rye Brook, Harrison, Mamaroneck, Larchmont. Going along these towns, Eastchester, what have you, Tuckahoe, like this, they've all got their own library. They've all got their own school superintendent. They've all got their own village manager, what have you. It's very inefficient the way we run government in Westchester County and in New York and in even in Yonkers, in my opinion.
So, I mean, Yonkers is a city. Greenwich is a town. I know what you're talking about with all the subdivisions, like Greenberg having Scarsdale and Elmsford and Hastings, but again, people can decide where they want to live and within their school district. There, Greenwich is a fully different model. I work for the school system in Greenwich, so I kind of know there. Most of the positions in government in Greenwich are unpaid, so they have a
they have a first selectman who makes about $140,000, maybe a little less.
Uh-huh.
When I was there, Peter Tessie only made $100,000.
The
second selectman, third selectman, they're unpaid positions. The Board of Assessment and Taxation, they're unpaid. The RTM, they're unpaid. There's only about three or four elected positions that are actually paid in Greenwich.
Yes.
Very
I'm
much
for
different.
That, too. I don't think it should
remember,
be a career to be a city council person, but it is in Yonkers, unfortunately.
Well,
I remember when
and it's funny what – yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking that I know when Victoria Garrity was the mayor in Ossining, she was only making $25,000 a year.
Yeah, and many of these small villages and towns, they don't pay their councilmen. We're the highest paid council in Westchester. I'm not disagreeing with that. You know, remember we used to have 12 councilmen, council people, in a different, you know, so that was all they made all part-time salaries before. But sometimes the expectation on council, they're expecting a full-time position. But I will say that primarily, I'd say the majority of the council doesn't have a lot to do because they're not working in the interest of their constituents. They're working
in
the interest
of others.
And I think
they're mostly fully employed in other occupations. This is a side job in a sense. You know, it's not their main main job or their main activity. It takes their time.
You're correct. Many have been given jobs by other municipalities or
self-employed or
public service corporations. Yeah, I think John Rubo, Anthony Moranti are the only ones self-employed, and Mike Green is retired. And I think Tasha has taken this on as her full-time job. The rest have gotten some sort of – I believe Shanae may be looking at school or something, I heard, and she was working for Cablevision. But Carzone has a job for Westchester County.
Development, I think.
I'm sorry?
I think it's in development or something like that, Office of
Development.
Yeah,
business development. I'm not exactly sure what that's for.
Yeah.
All I know is I pay for her trips to White Plains in her city-owned vehicle.
Yeah.
She shouldn't have.
It could be much more efficient
have
in
that
the city
capacity.
Of Yonkers.
I'm going to go off
the
top
because
you know,
it's
I,
for
I,
her
I
own
a,
personal stuff. It's not business. It's not government business. It's illegal. But we don't have law here.
But
we have laws. They've given them these vehicles and they put it up. But you have homeowners that that don't really object to it. You know, year after year they don't hear you guys bringing up the issue of how much. This council cost us, how much these benefits cost us, how inefficient certain parts of this government is. So you don't hear that. There's very, very good things about Yonkers, but there's also some needs for improvement, in my opinion.
Well, look, our taxes are relatively low compared to others in Yonkers, but you know, you also get what you pay for. So the school system is not where it should be. The conditions of the buildings are not where they should be.
I agree.
You know, on the ideas of the cars, though, I will say that if more people understood what's at stake when a council person, or not even a council person, look, I owned a bar, and I used to get a fellow from DPW in there. He had a car. He was he finished his shift at 1:30, and he was given a car, and he wasn't a manager in DPW. Just it was an extra car, so let's let him drive it. I think the only people who should have city vehicles are those who respond to emergencies off hours.
That's a good point.
And that's
I understand right. Position. Unfortunately, guys, they're gonna shut us down in like about 30 seconds.
All right. So I appreciate you letting me cut in on your time. My apologies.
Oh, absolutely.
No, I enjoyed it.
Time.
Yes.
So okay. Enjoy.
Listen, guys, all the best. Thank you for making it a great show.
Have a good week, Ezzy.
Bye bye.
Take care. You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ron. Take care. Be well. Bye, guys. Well, there we have it, and tomorrow's another day. Goodbye.